I first heard back in summer of 1988 that the seminary was moving here, it was a great joy because it meant, even though it was a bit of a drive, I could get to Mass. And I became one of those hangers-on that show up around seminaries. And then, while I was writing The Mouth of the Lion, I took refuge here for a while and got some very good work done here. The world, of course, is a tumultuous place, a noisy place. And it's very quiet here, and very beautiful here, and very peaceful here. And I was actually able to get some work done. So in that sense, too, it's a homecoming of sorts for me. And then I have to admit to a duplicitous motive. When His Excellency suggested I might come and speak to you, I looked at the calendar and deliberately juggled the days so I could be here tonight. Out of something of a selfish motive, because tomorrow is graduation day at the Naval Academy where I teach. And because I had been requested to give a lecture here, I could go to my chairman and say, I'm very sorry, I'm not going to be able to attend graduation this year because I'm going out to Minnesota to lecture at a seminary. He's a lapsed Catholic. It was a way of getting under his skin a bit. But the reason for that was our commander-in-chief, President Clinton, is addressing the graduating class tomorrow. And it's something that I'm very pleased to be missing. Very, very curious situation, needless to say, and one that is in some ways rather embarrassing and upsetting for many of the best young men who are at the Naval Academy, in that their commander-in-chief is now a draft dodger. And that legacy from the 60s is coming back to haunt us in very disturbing ways. And there are many of them who are uncomfortable with the fact that this is the man who will be giving them their diploma and telling them to go out and fight and die in defense of the nation. So there's something not quite right in that. And of course there's another problem. Some of you may have heard of this, but for the past year and a half, there has been a terrific scandal at the Naval Academy, a cheating scandal. An electrical engineering exam was compromised at the end of fall semester of 1992. And what happened was, it was clear that someone had purchased a copy of the exam from the print shop where the exam had been run off, then took it, and it spread throughout the brigade of midshipmen. It was known a number of people had access to the exam before the test. Six came forward and admitted early in 1993 that they had seen the exam ahead of time. Others knew of it, but after an investigation, those six were thrown out of the academy. There was great unhappiness because it was clear that many others had been involved. The leadership tried to stamp out the fires that were aflame all over the academy. It did not work. It turned ugly. Midshipmen called the Navy Inspector General and demanded an investigation. Others went to their congressman and demanded an investigation. The six who had been thrown out hired a lawyer and demanded there be a full investigation. And after that investigation finally took place, without really a great deal of happiness on the part of the leadership of the Academy, it was determined 133 had been involved, not six. Which suggests something was very much askew at this institution. It's true. It went downhill from there. It was simply a terrific mess. At the end of it, the last report, 24 have now been thrown out. Many of the others are graduating. Some of them who are graduating have gotten through by lying their way through, and everyone knows it. There is much unhappiness over that, so that the class of 94 is not going to have a happy graduation in any case. And sadly, the joke is going around that what they have done in inviting the commander-in-chief to come in is that they're bringing in the liar to speak to the cheaters. In any case, that's what's going on where I work. I tell the story partially by way of saying thank you for allowing me to come today to speak to you. This is a much better place to be. But also because it seems to me quite obvious what has happened at the Naval Academy that has brought it to this sorry pass is a lack of leadership. Those who were put in charge of the institution, those who were authorized, those who were given the authority to run one of the premier military academies in the United States to turn out graduates who will then serve the country, have not been doing their job. Brings us to this play, which begins with the problem of what happens when those in charge, what happens when those in authority don't exert that authority. What happens when those who should be making firm, often difficult decisions, those who are in charge of ruling, those who are in charge of defining for us how we must live and seeing to it that we live our lives that way, don't do their job. Now, this is not something, obviously, that simply applies to the American military. It's not something that applies, I think, to any one institution any longer. It is a problem across the board, and it's very clear. Shakespeare was aware of it in 1604. That one of the problems facing the world was a crisis of authority, a genuine crisis in leadership. That has happened, and it continues to happen. It results in peculiar things that no one anticipates at the time. If I may go back to the Academy again, it seems to me that one of the major failings that resulted in the present crisis actually came from a decision that was made nearly 20 years ago. I said it at table this noon, can you imagine what would happen here if the decision was made to allow 15 young women to come and study here at the seminary? And they would live with you. They would simply be part of your daily routine. There would be no change in the way life was lived here. They were simply now going to be incorporated. Well, that's the appropriate response. But sadly, when this was decided on the part of certain government officials back in the 70s, nobody laughed. It was taken quite seriously, and it happened. A failure of leadership. Those in charge knew very well what was going to happen. Those in charge had a vision of how severe it could be. Those in charge had, having grown up in the military, many of them having graduated from the academy, could have said in very practical terms why there would be problems with such a decision, but they didn't speak up. One, would have jeopardized their own career. It was, you've got to go with the flow. You can't fight it. It's what the American people have decided in there. And in failing to exert proper leadership and proper authority, the situation arose almost immediately where, in the brigade of now about 4,500 young people, there are approximately 700, 800 women who live in one dormitory with the young men, ages 18 to 25. Now, I'm fond of saying, if you had told this to our grandparents or our great-grandparents, they would have laughed, they would have been horrified, and they could have told you in an instant what was going to happen. And it's happened. And it's been happening for years. And everyone there knows it. And everyone looks the other way and says everything is fine. The city of Vienna, in Measure for Measure, has become a cesspool. A cesspool of corruption. And the man in charge, fully aware of it, says, well, I can't do anything. Once again, curiously, when leaders refuse to lead, when authority refuses to exercise its authority, it is not simply a political problem. As the author of this play was fully aware, knowing human behavior, the human heart, and human society, what happens is a loss of discipline on every level, including that most basic kind of human governance, that is, self-restraint, order, that is necessary for the proper running of any society. So what you have had in the institution where I teach for years now is incipient chaos. An institution run by lies, in which morality has been flouted, in which discipline has been lost, morale has collapsed, there is no self-restraint, there are no boundaries, so why not cheat? Cheating is the least of it compared to other things going on there. And if the authorities turn away and refuse to see that obvious wrong, why imagine they would see anything else? As many of them said, why pick on us? Why pick on us? Everybody's doing it, which is a cry that goes up from many of the characters in this play. Why pick on us? The corruption's everywhere. But suddenly the corruption becomes so evident, so obvious. Suddenly we have a national scandal. It's been in the newspapers. It's been in the media. Everyone's aware of it. Everyone's clucking their tongues and saying, well, what's happened here? Well, what's happened here? Well, anybody with a pea brain knows what's happened there, but we're not allowed to say it. And the newspapers won't report what's happened there. And the leadership won't admit what's happened there. And the problem goes way back. And it is a real problem, and it's a modern problem. There's only one solution. There's only one solution, and that solution is something that's been rejected. Out of hand. That is now viewed as the old problem we're getting rid of. Doesn't work. In any case, I think in certain respects, all of us are living through Measure for Measure. I'll give you some background. Well, let me say a few words about Shakespeare first. I'm very lucky. I'm critical of the Naval Academy. Now let me say a few nice words about the Naval Academy. They pay me to teach Shakespeare. I suspect if they didn't, I'd still be out on street corners sort of, you know, quoting sonnets and things. I have a deep and abiding love for Shakespeare that was given to me by an 8th grade English teacher. Wonderful woman named Marie Cahill, C-A-H-I-L-L, a Catholic lady, teaching in the public schools. I was a young Protestant. Look what can happen! And in a curious way, I do trace much of it back to her. She taught us grammar. She made us diagram sentences. She taught us good, solid literature, and boy did she discipline us. She was a lay person, but my vision of her now is one of those nuns that my Catholic friends tell me about from the old days, right? That ran the Catholic schools. Everyone was just in terror. And yet they all love. They love these ladies. They can't stop talking about them. And you see the good works that they have done. The fruits are evident. And they probably needed to be heavy-handed with the ruler occasionally. Well, she was like that. We spent 9 weeks on The Merchant of Venice. It was astonishing. She made us memorize a third of the play. We had tests on the characters. We did gigantic plot diagrams where we had to take the three plots and show how they were interwoven. You know, it was just craziness. It gave me a sense of structure and literature. I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't understand the point of it until much, much later. God bless her. She was a teacher who did her job. She taught me something. Most of my other teachers collected a paycheck. Didn't really know what to teach. She knew what to teach. She did it well. She was a Catholic. She retired early, sadly, because, as she said, the schools were changing. And there were no longer administrators in the school who would back her up. She wouldn't change her teaching methods. But as it became more difficult to discipline, there were no administrators to back her up, and she took an early retirement. Loss of authority, loss of leadership, and the good teachers headed for the hills. Who could blame them? God bless her, she gave me a deep and abiding love for Shakespeare. It continued on into my university days, and it has never left me. And curiously, in some ways, having immersed myself in Shakespeare, it was inevitable at some point I had to be a Catholic. I fully agree with the great poet T.S. Eliot, who says, Dante and Shakespeare divide the world between them. There is no third. And we're all well aware of Dante's position. He is the literary guide, if you will, the imaginative guide to the supernatural life. What he has done in the Divine Comedy is extraordinary, and it is a great, great literary work, thoroughly Catholic. But it's Catholic in that everyone can look directly at it and see it. It's about the Inferno, the Purgatorio, and the Paradiso. That's Catholic. And Dante was living in an Italy that was Catholic. Shakespeare's lot was more difficult. He was raised Catholic, born in 1564, raised Catholic by a father that we know was staunchly Catholic in a time when it was dangerous to be so. It was under the reign of Elizabeth I. The Church of England that had been founded by Henry VIII was everywhere. Catholicism was being stamped out, and it was in fact illegal to attend the Catholic Mass, and if you did so, you had to pay a fine. How do we know that Shakespeare was raised in a Catholic family? Because every week his father had to pay the fine. He wouldn't go to the Church of England service. He went to the Catholic Mass and paid his fine, and it was costly. Which means Shakespeare's father was a man of the faith. We also know that he had an education in Stratford, probably just to the 8th grade. We are told that he had small Latin and less Greek, but he had some languages. But the most important thing, in a way, we're coming up on Corpus Christi Day, and it's fascinating, and this is indeed how Catholic culture grew at that time. As late as into the 1580s, so all the time the young Will Shakespeare was growing up, on Corpus Christi Day, besides going to Mass, you had the great festival of the Corpus Christi mystery plays. And indeed, the family would have gone to Coventry, where the cycles were performed, and seen the cycles of the mystery plays telling the Bible stories from the creation to the Last Judgment. Each one of the guilds was responsible for one part of the story. They would have a pageant wagon. You would stand at one place in the road, and the creation and the fall and Cain and Abel and the flood would just wheel on by. They were short plays. They were short one-act plays. But in the course of that day, you would get the entire story of the faith. There it was. And this was what the young boy obviously was taken to as he was growing up, which means he was immersed in that vision of Catholic culture, but also Catholic storytelling. And if he came to love plays, we know what those first plays were that he saw. That is, he was Catholic. Now, clearly, he was not what we would call a virtuous young man, necessarily. We know that he married a woman 6 years elder than himself, and that 6 months later she gave birth to a child. So it was probably a shotgun wedding. Which means Claudio's situation in this play must have been something very close to his own heart. He knew what that was about. But the other thing we can say is that he did his duty, and indeed he married the woman and spent the rest of his time raising the family, putting bread on the table, working in the theater in London. And anyone who's been around theaters knows that they are not necessarily sanctuaries. They are filled with the hurly-burly of life. And at the same time, given his background, given the family I think he was raised in, showing the importance of that, given his first dramatic experience, clearly there was a Catholic mentality there. There was a Catholic sense. There was a Catholic heart. And to my mind, if Dante shows us the supernatural Catholic realm, that vision of what that supernatural realm is like, Shakespeare shows us the world from a Catholic point of view. I don't believe there's any other writer that has known the human heart as well. who has understood human drama. What human beings do to each other, how they live, how their personalities are formed, how they interact, their passions, their flaws, their glory, their, you name it, it's in those plays. And the viewpoint is Catholic. The situations are often worldly and often disturbing, but there's no doubting the vision with which it's worked out, or the extraordinary generosity of spirit he extends to his characters to give them, if you will, viable life. Those characters live. You watch a production such as Measure for Measure and understand how many unforgettable human beings are created in that one play, then multiply it by 37. There are 37 plays, each with casts of 30 to 40 characters. No character is too small. No character ever becomes a mouthpiece for the author. The author disappears, if you will, and allows the characters to live out their experience within the plays. And it's fascinating to see. There is, for this reason, I am convinced, because of the variety, the vision, the truth he tells, and the world can't get away from it. There is something true in these plays. There is something that from the time they were first premiered, from the time they first took the stage, have held our interest. They've held the interest of ages that at the time yet unborn. And they continue to do so. And that truth has got to be a Catholic truth, because truth is Catholic. There is that in these plays which speaks to everyone, which also has a kind of universality. Every night, somewhere in the world, these plays are being performed. They have crossed all the boundaries. There really is nowhere in the world where the plays have not been performed. They speak to everyone. They are universal. They are Catholic. And, of course, they are possessed of great beauty. Great beauty. He was a master poet. What he does with the language is extraordinary. Absolutely extraordinary. If we're talking of something that has at its basis a good vision that is filled with truth, communicated with beauty, what other source could there be? We know what the inspiration must be. Now, the world doesn't necessarily like this. It is very interesting. There is a book that came out recently by a man named Alan Bloom, who wrote a book called The Closing of the American Mind. He was a professor at the University of Chicago and hated by the liberals. The liberals detest the man because he attacked academia. He attacked much of what's going on in America. It's a spotty book, I think. His vision is off and on. But in his recent book called Love and Friendship, he makes a very good point. It was published after his death. He said, Shakespeare is perhaps our last literary link to the past. The modern world has managed to jettison almost everyone. And by that he means, Dante, though we honor him, and though he is read in certain schools, is no longer part of the popular imagination. You're not going to see discussions of the Purgatorio showing up on television. It's not going to happen. You're not going to find young people who have read the Purgatorio or the Inferno or the Paradiso as part of their education. It's not going to happen. And yet, this playwright last year had a film in the top 20 moneymakers of 1993. 2 years ago, maybe it was 3 years ago, he had a film in the top 10 moneymakers. Last year, a production of Much Ado About Nothing. Huge hit. And it was done straightforwardly. And people went to see it. Mel Gibson played Hamlet. And the people poured out to see it, partially because it was Mel Gibson. At the same time, there it was. Shakespeare continues to be popular. He has not yet been thrown into that past. He is, if you will, a link with the Catholic past, and the liberals are very uncomfortable with him. The modernists would just as soon he be gone. They're doing whatever they can to topple him. They're chipping away at him. They're writing insane analyses of the plays. They are very upset and trying to get some of them knocked off reading lists. My own chairman told me in a conversation we had about 3 weeks ago that The Merchant of Venice is anti-Semitic and shouldn't be taught. There are certain plays that I deliberately use in order to provoke my students. You can imagine what happens in a modern classroom when you walk in and the first play they read at the beginning of the semester is The Taming of the Shrew. Whoa! Fasten your seatbelts. And the response is unbelievable, and yet it's a great play. They can't ignore what it's saying, and it is as disturbing in its way as, and you know the type, I'm thinking of Padre Rifan in Brazil. Big, jolly, happy man. No matter what he says, people love him. Absolutely love him. And then they'll stop and realize what he's been talking about and what he's been saying. They'll take the message because the man presenting it is so delightful. And only later realize what that message was. That's Shakespeare's comedies. People will read Taming of the Shrew. I will show them. There's a wonderful film of that, Franco Zeffirelli film with Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton. Glorious film. They'll sit there absolutely loving it. And then Kate comes in at the end and kneels down before her husband and says, thy husband is thy sovereign, thy lord. And the room goes silent. But there it is. But there it is, and they've got to deal with it because they can't ignore the man. He speaks to us. Now, I will admit one reason he speaks to us is in some ways he was not a torn individual, but a man with one foot in each of two different camps. If I made the case that he grew up watching the medieval mystery plays, he also went and worked in London under Elizabeth I, who was installing Protestantism throughout England. He was, if you will, working under a modernist monarch with a modernist vision, and the modern world had come to England. You have a man who quite literally had one foot in the medieval world and one foot in the modern world. He understood both. And it is not accidental that the form he chose to express his art was drama. Because drama is the literary form that is based on conflict. At the core of any drama, you have two sets of ideas that are battling one another. Or two characters, Petruchio and Kate in Taming of the Shrew, or two characters who are battling one another. Two different visions of the world battling one another. And in a comedy, they can be resolved. And in a tragedy, one crushes the other with a tremendous sense of loss. This man wrote dramas because he was living in a time of drama. And I think he himself had a clear understanding of the two different worlds that he was part of, and gave expression to it in great plays. And he still speaks to us because, being human, we still have that within us which is medieval. That is, we are still creatures of God. We have spiritual lives. We respond to beauty and truth. We can't get rid of that, much as the modernists would like to chuck it all. We can't get rid of it. And at the same time, we're living in a modern world. So there is that in Shakespeare that appeals to us on both levels. And as we watch this battle, we're watching our battle. We're still living through it. And the man can still define for us problems that still exist out there. And in some plays, he defines them more clearly than in other plays. There are some plays that from the beginning, I think the time they first hit the stage, defined the problem for us and spoke to an entire world that was shifting. Hamlet, obviously. Hamlet is the place where the modern world just explodes onto the stage. And in that tortured young man's mind, filled with doubt, uncertainty, we have that vision of modern man. And Hamlet has been popular from the first day it appeared on the stage. There were other plays that were not necessarily as popular that suddenly have come into their own. I was looking in preparation for coming here tonight at an essay about Measure for Measure written in the early 1960s, in which the author talks about the fact that it is sad the play is so rarely produced. early 1960s. In the last 3 years, there have been 4 productions just in the Washington-Baltimore area by major theaters. Suddenly, this is one of his most popular plays. I believe that is not accidental. He was ahead of us. We've caught up with him. This is a play that speaks indeed to our age, an age that is corrupt, in which the authorities have given up their authority, in which we are wandering the streets, or if you will, all in prison, condemned to death, not knowing how we got there, how we can get out of there, what it means. This is, in some ways, a more contemporary play than plays written in the last 5 years. And suddenly it's being done everywhere. It's an extremely popular play. It again simply underlines my point that this man could speak to things that he saw about him and could speak to things that were yet to come. And here we are now. Shakespeare is worth studying for that reason, I believe. He is instructive, he is informative, he is entertaining. Even his rascals are entertaining. The fellow who plays Pompey in the production is just wonderful. You wouldn't want to spend much time living with a character like Pompey, but it's simply wonderful to watch him at a distance. And again, Shakespeare has great respect for such a character, and Pompey is playing a very important role in the design of this play. I'll come back to that. There was another difficulty. This play is a play that has troubled many commentators for many years, and it still troubles people who produce the play. There is a very dark side to it, and for many years it was called one of his dark comedies. The golden comedies come early in his career. Midsummer Night's Dream, Taming of the Shrew, Much Ado About Nothing, As You Like It, Twelfth Night. Plays that envision the perfection of a golden world where there can be compromise and great joy. He then turned to the tragedies, and Measure for Measure is written in the midst of the great tragedies. When he wrote this play, he had already written Hamlet and Othello. On the horizon, King Lear and Macbeth. So that this play comes smack in the center of the 4 great tragedies, which means we know what was going on in his mind. It was a time of turmoil and doubt. He was looking at the world around him and re-examining everything that he had believed, that he thought. He was questioning, he was probing. And they are plays that have a dark vision. To write a comedy at such a time is an unusual thing. And there are dark elements in this play, clearly. It is, in some ways, a serious comedy. It is a comedy dealing with very serious issues. And they're inescapable. It is a comedy in which the characters themselves are taking actions that are not necessarily appropriate for the world of a comedy. This is Shakespearean comedy in particular is often about romance, love and romance, and takes a golden view of it. Youthful, vibrant, alive, filled with joy, and such plays end with weddings because, the wedding, all comedy in a sense grows out of the wedding feast at Cana. The recognition that the union of man and woman, blessed by God in this world, is an occasion of great joy, and it is a possibility. It is a possibility. It is a time for festive happiness and great joy. That is what comedy is about. In this play, we get a happy ending, but it is a tortured path that we have to climb before we get there. And there seems at points very little assurance that we will get there. Now, another difficulty is that while he was writing this play, he was operating under a burden, and that is the religious problems had become so great in England that it was forbidden for a playwright to mention the name of God on the stage. God was simply to not be a part of what you were putting on the stage. The stage was to be entertainment. You don't get into religious questions because there was already too much animosity. There were too many problems. And there was an edict saying you don't even mention the name of God any longer. I think one of the great tragedies of literature is that as Shakespeare grew in wisdom and wrote his later plays when he was, I am convinced, devoutly putting forth a Catholic vision in the midst of a Protestant society, he was not free to speak openly. It is there, we can see it, when we get to the late romances, which are to my mind, the most extraordinary literary works ever created that give us a sense of God's providence working in the world. And they're Catholic. They have to be fairy tales. Because he cannot speak directly about what he is talking about. It was forbidden. In that sense, perhaps we would say he was not a brave man. And at the same time, as we watch those plays or read them, it's very clear what it is he's telling us. In this play as well, it's fairly clear what he's up to, in that the title alone tells us, is a little clue, that this may not be an openly religious work such as he saw as a child in the medieval mystery plays, but a play called Measure for Measure would have instantly taken his audience back, in a way it doesn't for a modern audience, to the opening of Matthew 7, "Judge not, lest ye be judged. For with which judgment you judge, ye shall be judged, and with what measure ye mete it out, it shall be measured to you again." The title is a reference to the Gospels. And it is a specific warning, if you will, about behavior in the world. And the title uses the phrase measure for measure, but the audience would have known the first part of that. Judge not, lest ye be judged. And this is in many ways a play about judgment. This is in many ways a play about judgment. And a warning to judges, a warning to average citizens, a warning to each individual to take care because the moment of judgment is something we will all face. The play is designed to reinforce that theme. The production you saw, done by the BBC, does a good job of that and conveys it, I think, quite wonderfully. If you look, there is a pattern of settings that the action of the play goes through. We begin in, if you will, the palaces of justice. We're in enclosed rooms. We're in that place where the judges are meant to judge. And then slowly as the play progresses, we descend out of those halls of justice where the ruler should rule into a prison. And much of the center of the play is not just dark in its themes, dark in the ideas it's looking at. It's dark because we are in a prison. Acts 3 and 4 of the play take place almost exclusively in the prison with characters either behind bars, speaking through bars, characters hiding and overhearing, and with the death sentence hanging over those who are locked in that prison. And that is not accidental. There is the sense of the play has moved, the action of the play, all the characters have moved into that prison, and there is a death sentence over them, and in Renaissance typology, that prison would have been a vision of the earth. We're here. We're trapped. How do we get out? Is there anyone who will save us? And of course, what comes at the end of the play, and we even have, in case, it's very easy to miss, this is the sort of thing that Shakespeare does brilliantly, we come to Act 5 of the play, and as we lead into it, we know that we're going no longer inside the halls of judgment, we're no longer in the prison, we're all going to the gates of the city, that vast open space, and standing before the Duke who has returned, he's there. The judge is now going to judge, but it's not in private. And he's not giving judgment in the prison. It is public. And everything is going to be revealed publicly in front of everyone else. This is not a private reckoning. And in case we miss it, the Duke at Acts 4, scene 4, 5 gives to Friar Peter the following instructions. Bid them bring the trumpets to the gate. And in case we miss it that time, we're told again that twice the trumpet hath sounded. Okay? So that as we're moving into that open space, as the characters are assembling, as it's all going to be made clear and worked out, the very trumpets are sounding, there's no mistaking what he's telling us. That last scene of the play is a type of Judgment Day. And the Judgment Day is suddenly, it is a moment that comes on everyone unexpectedly. And even as it begins, as they've gathered there, they do not know that the very man who will judge them is walking among them. Yes, he is there, he returns, he is visible, and then he reassumes his disguise as the friar and walks among the crowd again. He is there, if you will, almost in two persons. As divine judge, and as one of them moving through them, offering them aid, offering them comfort, being there to support them. It's a glorious scene. It's a glorious scene. And it's not until that last moment when Lucio pulls the hood off, and suddenly through his own pride and actions, what he reveals is the Duke. And is that, you'll notice it happens to many of the characters. It happens to Angelo, who all of a sudden, boom, yep, I'm caught, I'm nailed, and he says, oh, what can I say? Caught me, got me. And the same thing happens to Lucio right at the end. All of a sudden, it's like, boom, oh, the friar is the Duke, oh! That's what he used to say, well, shut my mouth! but we know precisely, we are told, this is how judgment will occur. This is how judgment will occur. We're being led there. It's clear as you follow the play, it's going to be worked out. We don't know the how of it. The characters moving through the play have no glimmer of what's coming. And they think, Angelo thinks he's just going to get away with it. And Lucio is still bad-mouthing the Duke right to the last moment before, boom, he reveals it. What can you say? What can you say? We have a type of Judgment Day. And it's in the open square. And it's where? At the gates of the city. And who is standing at the gates of the city? Friar Peter. You know, tell me the man's not Catholic. Now, obviously, it's still a play. It's still an entertainment. But there is no doubt for an audience that had been raised with all of that, that's working on them. It's not working on a modern audience in quite the same way, but I'll tell you this. Any human being viewing that play is caught up short with that sense of revelation. Sudden revelation, you're trapped in your sins, and you're before your judge. Any human being can still understand that. And there is also something else about when those trumpets sound, it is a glorious moment in the theater, it's wonderfully theatrical, but the sounding of the trumpets in and of itself has an effect on us. And in comes the Duke, and there's a sense of, whoa, okay, straighten up, look, okay. And we all know what that's like. Suddenly you're in the presence of something, of someone who may indeed have authority. Who may indeed suddenly begin judging and, well, is my hair right? Okay, my time right? Okay. And suddenly we're very conscious of it, and the play is moving that way. My point being this, the play is designed that way. The palace of justice into the prison, fearing death, and then suddenly the gates of the city, the trumpets, the open square, and all is revealed. And all is revealed, all is made clear. He knew what he was up to. And there is punishment and there is reward. There is punishment and there is reward. There is a clear separation. The astonishing thing, the hopeful thing, the reason this is still a comedy, is that mercy flows at that moment. Mercy flows at it. No one gets away with anything. No one gets away with anything. Everything is set in order, but it is done so with a degree of mercy that is almost unbelievable. Angelo's punishment, marrying this woman. And he calls for death and is told, nope, nope, Nope. You won't be lucky enough to die. You have to live with it now. You have to go on. Lucio at the end, who is the last one, okay? And the Duke says, drag him around the city, let him be whipped and hanged. And then he says, well, okay, forget that. But you're going to marry that woman you got pregnant. You're going to support her. And he says, Lucio screams out, marrying a punk is whipping and hanging. Don't kill me, kill me. And again, the Duke says, nope. Your punishment, you're going to live with her and be a good husband. It's a perfect punishment. It's a proper punishment. It's the punishment to end a great comedy. But for Lucio, it's punishment. It's punishment. Okay? What's her name? Mistress Kate Keepdow is the name of the woman that he's marrying. Okay? Oh, and of course, he's full of himself. He has a vision of it. It's humbling. Lucio is humbled at the end. And yet, there is a sense of mercy. It is just. It is just. And yet, there is a sense of mercy. Now, I said that all plays are based on a conflict, on a central conflict. This is a particularly unusual play, in that in most of Shakespeare's plays, it is one character versus another character. In this play, we have something different. We have, the central character is the Duke. There's no getting around it. He is the central figure in the play. And sometimes that's hard to see because he is a shadowy figure. He is a man who is sought to withdraw into the background. He is a man who has not wanted a prominent position. He is a man who spends most of the play in disguise. And yet, he is the central figure. It is his story. He is the one that we must follow through because everything he has done and continues to do affects all of the other characters. His actions are central. What is the conflict? It is a man quite literally in conflict with himself. And as a result, in conflict with that society that he was meant to govern. His assigned task as Duke of Vienna was to rule the city. And that is what he has not done. And in fact, we are given that information early on. It is not accidental that the very first thing we see him do is step down from power. He begins the play by talking to Aeschylus, the good wise old man, the one who probably should have taken power, who has the balance all the way through. Shakespeare always respects the wisdom that comes with age. And saying, oh, I could tell you about government. I could speak to you, let's use the words. Of government, the properties to unfold would seem in me to affect speech and discourse. Since I am put to know that your own science exceeds in that the list of all advice my strength can give you, I could tell you about government, but that would I'd be affected. I won't do that because you know all about it. We begin with the man who is supposed to have this as his central concern, saying, well, I'm not going to talk about governing. I'm only a duke. I won't talk about governing. Besides, you know all about it anyway. Besides, I'm going to step down now. I'm going away. I'm going to put somebody else in my place. The play that comes right after this play, King Lear, is the same idea in a darker vein. That play also begins with a ruler who gives up his rule. The king steps down, divides his kingdom, and that's a very dark play. Shakespeare at this moment in his career is obsessed with authority that gives itself away. Authority that gives up.
This concludes the first CD. Please insert CD 2.